maybe Jasper Philipson forgot to put like the little guard on. Because do you remember when everyone was giving each other haircuts in lockdown? Me and my friends were doing it when we were living together. And I think we did that once where it's just like, because obviously none of us had ever cut anyone's hair before. And then suddenly you start and it's just like, oh, that is your, that's your scalp. So now you are bald.
Welcome back to the Placeholder Podcast, everybody. I'm Caleb Fretz. We got a great show for you today. We've got Tour de Suisse. We've got a Dauphiné wrap-up. We've got Ronan breaking a record and raising a bunch of money for a worthy cause. A little update on, well, the fact that you're going to be able to hear race radios during the Tour de France this year. We're going to talk about that. And we're going to talk a little bit about Unchained, the Netflix doc that we are making an entire separate podcast about. So we're not going to go into it too deeply, but we did want to touch on it. We wanted to touch on it today, just for folks who are not listening to the regular Unchained binge pod. We have some thoughts. Joining me today, Dane Cash. Welcome back.
Hey, Kaylee. How are you?
I'm doing great. Johnny Long, reclined.
Reclined, as always. It's my new marginal gain as we head into tour season.
Johnny hasn't done any work in any way vertical for, what, at least a week? It's been all horizontal work.
Yeah, recommend it.
And Ronan, you actually have an excuse to potentially do that because you had quite a long bike ride over the weekend. Are you recovered?
Yeah, I think I'm recovered at this point. Well, I'm recovered so long as I don't get on a bicycle. I'm sure I'd feel pretty crap then, but general decent day-to-day feeling is back to normal today.
Well, glad to have you back. Glad to have you back on the show.
Thank you.
We want to kick off today's episode with a thank you, just like we did last week. So this podcast, all of our podcasts, all of Escape Collective is funded by our members, and we'd like to just thank some of our lifetime members at the start of each show. So thank you today to David Williams, John Lowe, Kent Voss, Kurt Holzer, and Josh Hilby. You make our world go round. Thank you so much for being a lifetime member. And if you are not already a member of Escape Collective, you're not supporting this podcast and you're listening to it. Head over to escapecollective.com/join. And make sure that you get full access to the site ahead of the Tour de France, which you're definitely going to want. Plus, support what we do here on the pods. Please and thank you. All right. Let's get into today's show. Let's kick off with an internal story. Anybody who follows Ronan on Instagram, actually we chucked a couple reposts up on the Escape Collective Instagram as well, will have seen, Ronan, you broke a kind of big important record over the weekend. Explain what you were up to on Sunday, and let's talk about it a little bit.
I sort of thought that times were a bit quiet, and I better go out and drum up some news stories for us. So I got a lift down to the most southerly tip of Ireland, and then cycled back to the most northerly point of Ireland, which thankfully is just about 40 kilometers from my home, and then in doing so, broke the record for, I suppose, what's commonly known as the end-to-end type of ride. Here in Ireland we call it the Mizzenhead to Malinhead, because that's the name of the two points that you cycle between if you're cycling that the Irish version of an end-to-end.
How long did it take you?
It took me 15 hours and 30 minutes 36 seconds,
which is what, like an hour, 2 hours, 2.5 hours faster than the
it
record
was
you
an
took
hour
a
and...
sizable chunk off.
An hour and 50 off the record of 17 hours and 21 minutes, which was set by Galway man Sean Hernan in September 2021. And funny story about that, I actually was driving to the airport to fly to Flanders for the Flanders World Championships, if you remember that, in September 21. And the guy who was my crew chief at the weekend and usually is for these sorts of events happened to just stumble upon Hernan completing his ride as he came through our sort of local area on the way to Malinhead, and followed him the whole way to Malinhead. So I was getting like blow by blow live coverage of this event that pretty much nobody knew was happening, just absolutely coincidentally.
Tell me about what you were. So you were riding this for a charity that's close to you and close to your family. We should mention that, and also maybe give people the opportunity to head over and chuck some bucks at it if they want to.
Yeah, well, I was doing it for two charities, the Natasha Foundation in the UK, which is set up to sort of raise awareness and improve education and advocate for safer foods in terms of food allergy awareness, and the Red Sneakers for Oakley Foundation in on your side of the Atlantic. Both those charities are sort of operating in the food allergy awareness space, and that's sort of important to me because... Well, it's not sort of, it's really important to me because my daughter has a food allergy. She is specifically, she's allergic to nuts and raw eggs, and quite severe in both cases. And that the one time she happened to get a bit of peanut butter, which was how we found out she had nut allergies, that was a very scary moment. And the one time she happened to touch a raw egg, which again was how we found out about that allergy, that was also very serious, involved a rush to the hospital. She had actually passed out. We had to give her an EpiPen, two actually, and she had spent a night in the hospital. So it's fairly serious. And it, you know, I'm not, my goal here wasn't to advocate that we should ban nuts or something like that. It's more just around sort of trying to raise awareness in that, you know, for some reason I'm not aware of all of the science and all behind it, but for some reason allergies are on the increase. And from the way it was explained to me, in that, you know, my daughter's four now. If she had been four 30 years ago, she might have been the only kid in a school with a food allergy of any sort. And nowadays there's, you know, a handful, maybe more per classroom that have a food allergy. And as such, pretty much all of us will know somebody who's affected by this. And there's actually quite a lot that we can do, even without food allergies, just to make a sort of safer environment for those who do have a food allergy. And most of that just revolves around being aware of the symptoms. So like hives or swelling or anaphylactic shock, or just being aware of what a food allergy reaction looks like and how to administer an EpiPen if someone needs it. The advice is always, if in doubt, administer it, in that, you know, you can't really do too much damage in giving someone an EpiPen, but if they don't get it soon enough, it could be fatal. So for me, it was just a, you know, a case of trying to bring a bit of awareness to this, trying to raise some money for those two charities. There's a link to the fundraiser on my Instagram, and part of that was in wearing the red cycling shoes that I wore for the attempt, and the Red Sneakers for Oakley Foundation. They have actually set up International Red Sneakers Day as a sort of awareness campaign around food allergies. And so I thought I would, you know, sort of ditch the Aero overshoes that I ordinarily would have worn for that ride and show off the red shoes that I happen to have. And hopefully by getting this message out there, anytime someone sees a photo of that, if they know the story behind the red shoes, it might just be a little reminder that actually there's a heck of a lot that you and I can do to help people with food allergies.
And if you need proof that Ronan cares deeply about this, you left the Aero overshoes off. The greatest sacrifice you could have made.
There, I spent this morning writing up a full optimizing a 15-hour time trial article. So there's plenty that should be up on the site pretty soon. There's plenty there for folks to delve into. I might have ditched the Aero overshoes, but there was still some hacks involving finding a carbon sole that I was able to do with the red shoes to try and claw back a few of those gains that I'd left behind.
How much time do you reckon you left out on the road with that choice?
Oh, it's actually probably a net equal, I would say, because I might have worn overshoes and been a little bit faster, but actually it was so hot on Sunday. Maybe the extra heat from overshoes would have been actually detrimental. So haven't even thought about it.
Yet.
That's a lie. Well, yeah, go check out Ronan's story. By the time you listen to this podcast, that will be up, I think. How to optimize for a 15-hour time trial, and then we'll stick a link to donate in that story as well, so you can drop some in if you if you so desire.
I might just add one more thing and just explain the two biggest fears that I have as a parent of someone who has a nut allergy. And you know, everywhere you go, you have to explain that, you know, my daughter has a nut allergy, and we're perfectly fine with that. Sometimes you feel like you're, you know, being awkward, but actually it's just the way you have to be. And actually recently, one of the most difficult moments for me was recently when my daughter turned to my wife after she had just been to the dentist for the very first time. She was excited about that. My wife had told the dentist about the nut allergy and the different allergies that she had. And it was about half an hour after they left the dentist, and my daughter said, "Mom, why do you have to tell everybody about my nut allergy? I don't want to tell people about that." And, you know, it's that was just heartbreaking. But in terms of what's most sort of scary for us is two things, actually: air travel. And, you know, everybody at some point will want to take their kids on holidays. But actually, thankfully, a lot of the airlines in Europe are very, very good. But, you know, you do hear horror stories about some airlines, and not naming any names, but Qatar Airlines. Sorry, I didn't name there. They actually put all the onus on the person with a food allergy here and refuse not to serve nuts, which to me is just a bit ridiculous, considering that, you know, none of us will die if we don't get nuts, but someone could die if they do get nuts. And then there's other horror stories of just other passengers being very, very inconsiderate and, you know, refusing not to eat nuts again, even though they've been asked by the airline. The airline have said there's no nuts been served and no nuts should be consumed on this flight. So those are very, very scary moments. We've only ever had her on one flight for that very reason. And the other one was just the sort of fantastic Irish hospitality, in that, you know, Irish grannies especially and mommies are just, you know, they'll hand you sweets for no reason, even if you're a complete stranger. And, you know, should someone hand Sophia a Snickers bar or something like that, that could be life-threatening. So those things are quite scary. And that's why I want to raise awareness, is just that, you know, you know, just consider if someone may have a food allergy before we open something in a confined environment like an airplane, or you know, if we're giving kids who may or may not know that they have a food allergy, that we just, you know, take a second to think about that.
This is a serious tangent for a bike racing or cycling yeah. podcast, but the food allergy thing is really fascinating to me, because there's this weird, like, cultural acceptance of thinking it's like psychosomatic, that it's like this allergy is in people's heads. And I think maybe that's because of what you mentioned earlier, the fact that it's on the rise. And so, like, a lot of us grew up with like one kid that had a nut allergy, or our parents grew up with no kids that had a nut allergy, and all of a sudden there's four in a classroom and people are like, well, are the kids just making this up? And no, clearly they are not. And like, I think that from an awareness perspective, some of it is fighting back against that very strange notion that you would just invent a nut allergy in your brain, which is not what is happening. Anyway, worth shouting about.
Actually, linked to pro cycling, there was one pro cyclist who retired recently, but and I'm still sort of looking at the story, so I won't name any names or teams involved. But there was one World Tour team who this rider rode for, and repeatedly the team hadn't implemented the proper sort of safety standards, and simple things like staff or riders using a knife for Nutella and then putting it straight into jam, and this rider took an allergic reaction to the Nutella because he had a nut allergy and had to go home from races on seemingly countless occasions because just his food had been contaminated. And, you know, while that was, you know, obviously bad that he had to go home from a race and had to, you know, suffer a reaction, you know, through something that was entirely avoidable, and I can't understand how the team just didn't clamp down it when it was clearly a performance issue for the team. But if it was someone who actually that could have been fatal for, that, you know, it just doesn't even bear thinking about.
Yeah,
it's also just gross behavior, using one knife for another. Like, I thought this is 2023. I thought we'd left that way behind.
Double dipping, yeah. Like, I mean, I thought that was just a no-go.
Clearly not.
Well, if you're at the end of 15 minutes of cycling podcast and wondering how we've gotten this far just talking about nut allergies, this is the placeholder podcast. That's what you get sometimes on this one. If you want some pretty serious bike racing, we do have a podcast for that. But let's pivot. Let's pivot back to direct connection to cycling. Like I said, go check out Ronan's story up on the site. Go check out his Instagram. Donate if you feel like doing that. But otherwise, you know, just be more aware of nut allergies in your life. I think that's the biggest number one thing that we want everyone to take away from that little chat. Let's get into bike racing a little bit. So we've got the Dauphiné, we've got Tour de Suisse still ongoing. We've also got some crazy stuff in Pyrenees. We've got, I kind of want to talk about Lenny Martinez on Vontoux yesterday. I think he's a particularly interesting person. So we got a whole bunch of things to talk about. Let's kick off with the Dauphiné. Dane, how did this wrap up? This one's going to be a pretty easy one to sum up, I think.
Yeah, wrapped up kind of the way that we expected it to wrap up. Jonas Vingegaard went in as the heavy favorite, and he came out as the obvious clear winner. There's not that much else to say. He crushed everybody, basically. He was kind of supposed to, because just if you look at the start list, he was clearly the rider that was favored here. And I think he did himself a favor by coming out of this as the clear winner. No questions here. And even though the tour is still a few weeks away, he's clearly already in pretty good shape.
There was a stage that stuck out to me from the Dauphiné. We were all expecting him to do really well on some of the big mountain stages. We were expecting him to do well, in any time trial situation, which turns out he did. He finished second in that TT. But the stage that actually stuck out to me was stage five, which ended in Salins-les-Bains, which was the best way I can describe it in terms of context is really similar to the first two stages of this year's Tour de France. It was very punchy, shorter climbs. That was actually the stage where he ended up running a one-by, so single front chain ring on his bike. So that kind of tells you that the climbs were short enough, that the speeds were high enough that he could do that, right? He's not going to do that over the Tourmalet in July, for example. At least we don't think so. That would be very strange.
I mean, didn't Ronan break the Everesting record on a one-by?
Different.
Slightly different scenario.
I don't know. I feel like if Ronan can do it.
Ronan didn't have to chase anybody down mountains as well as up. All yeah, anyway. Right. Slightly All different right. Slightly different scenario. Very unlikely that we see a one-by, I think, from Vingegaard in a truly big mountain stage at the Tour de France. Anyway, that's beside the point. My point here was that those type of stages, these kind of like punchy rolling stages, second place on that day was Julian Alaphilippe. This is like an Alaphilippe day written all over it, right? Those historically... Well, and I say historically, Jonas Vingegaard has not been sort of at the top of the sport for that long. But we didn't think of him as particularly well-suited to that type of stage. He seemed to be a little bit less punchy. We saw at the Tour de France last year that generally if Tadej Pogacar kind of wanted to like pip him at the line, he could. A little bit more kind of like outright power in those kind of situations. And so I was looking at the opening week of this year's Tour de France, which has these really difficult opening stages, and thinking that that was probably advantage Pogacar. But that one stage of the Dauphiné kind of flipped my head on that a little bit. I mean, Pogacar's still going to be very good at those days. He's still won days that fit that same mold. But I thought Jonas Vingegaard was particularly impressive on that stage in a place where I didn't think he would be that impressive. So I guess bad news for everyone else is what I'm saying.
I feel like the steepness of this climb, it was like 8%, right? I mean, that's steep enough, I feel like, that I don't know how many conclusions. Because even in the Basque Country where the climbs are short and steep, 8% would be a lot. And I'm just kind of curious. I mean, that it definitely was a sign. It's sort of a sign that maybe he's improved in that department, or maybe we've underestimated him in that department. But I don't know yet that I'm like fully ready to buy in that he's going to beat Pogacar at like Liège, you know, and also in the first week of the tour.
It was, you know, no doubting it. Vingegaard was massively impressive on that stage, but you know, obviously he's in good form. But was he also sort of, I don't want to say flattered by the field, but you know. It was not the same quality as the Tour will be. Is it the same quality of field as Tour de Suisse? You know, you could argue that one either way. But I think that you know, as impressive as he was that day, he was also sort of helped by the fact, you know, Alaphilippe is not the rider he once was. Hopefully he has come. He seems like he's on the road back to being the rider he once was. But you know, I just think as impressive as Vingegaard was that day, it wasn't really a stacked top 10 when you look at Hoekeman just behind him there.
I guess maybe the one thing is that at least Vingegaard goes into the tour with far less doubts from within and like from the media, especially within, because we've seen in the Netflix series about how questioning they were of themselves when they're going up against Pogacar, when it still wasn't clear that they were going to beat him. Whereas now Pogacar's coming back from his injury. We've seen now he's riding without his sort of wrist brace and he's also out of the saddle. But he's going to have far more questions, I think, until because he's not doing any warm-up races either. So, you know, that whole week of like build up and all the interviews and stuff, we'll just be asking him how he's feeling. And then I think naturally that makes, I mean, maybe, you know, who knows Tadej Pogacar's psyche. If there's anyone who can just like brush it off and be like, no, I'm fine, then it's him. But still, I think he's maybe going to have a bit more nagging doubt this time around than Jonas.
That's kind of what I was thinking when I said that he did what he was supposed to do. And that's, I think that's all he could do. Vingegaard, that is. The field, yeah. Just, yeah, as Ronan pointed out, it's, I feel like this is a surprisingly not great field at the Dauphiné. I think part of that is that, you know, Primoz Roglic decided to race the Giro this year and a couple of other riders just weren't around. And also the big reason is Tadej Pogacar not being here. So what he was supposed to do was win handily, and he did. And then beyond that, I feel like it is kind of hard to draw conclusions, but yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't draw much conclusions from like overall GC picture. That was just the one thing that stood out to me, is I think he's worked on this. I think that they've paid attention to the fact that the Tour opens in this way. I mean, the very first stage of the Tour de France is going to be, I think, fascinating this year. It'll all be how the racers race it, but it has the opportunity to be kind of chaotic in that it's a really hard stage. You've got sort of like legitimate run at sort of polka dots already up for grabs. You've got yellow jersey up for grabs. You've got time bonuses on the final climb of the day, plus time bonuses at the finish line. I think it's an interesting way to start the Tour de France this year. We'll get into like a real Tour de France preview a little bit closer to the race, but I was writing a bunch of the preview stuff last week, and yeah, those first 2 days I think are cleverly done by the tour organizer to potentially kick this thing off with some drama.
And knowing that Pogacar's coming in possibly not at his best yet, or maybe he's planning to work his way into form just based on the timeline of his recovery, maybe the strategic thing for Jumbo-Visma to do, also the ruthless thing, but the thing they might do is attack early on those stages. So maybe that's part of it, is that they're thinking, all right, Jonas, get better at that, because we're gonna try to take it to Pogacar really early.
That'd probably also be the safest thing to do, because the Tour is always carnage in the opening stages, and I predict it'll be even more chaotic in the opening stages this year. So, you know, just naturally, if you're riding an aggressive race, you're probably going to be slightly safer, slightly out of harm's way, if you can be on the first stage of the Tour. But yeah, that's a good shout then. I wouldn't be surprised to see that sort of tactic at all, given just think about San Sebastian, how chaotic that usually is as a one-day race, and then combine it with the first stage of the Tour and all the pressure and everything that's at stake with the Tour de France. That's my biggest concern about the opening week of this year's Tour, is just, you know, who's going to come out of it still in the race and then potentially be a favorite, rather than who's a favorite going to do it.
Other takeaways from the Dauphiné, for me, Julian Alaphilippe winning a stage was a really good sign. You know, to return to these first two stages, couple stages of the Tour de France, they have Alaphilippe written all over them in a normal year, or they would have 3 years ago. And him winning a stage of the Dauphiné certainly points in that direction again. And, you know, an Alaphilippe yellow jersey in the first week is not something I'm ever going to say no to.
What I will say to that, though, is that I think a couple of weeks ago we saw a picture of Mathieu van der Poel at altitude, and he'd completely shaved his head. So if he's, you know, if he's, especially when they're sponsored by Alpecin, if he's shaved all of his luscious locks off, then clearly he's just all for going in to be, because he's kind of the guy who's taken over from the Alaphilippe stages, right? And like, we saw that a couple of years ago. So I think a shaved head for Van der Poel is very ominous.
Perhaps he just asked Jasper the Disaster to give him a haircut and ended up getting the Mach 3 out.
If you don't understand that reference, make sure you should go watch Unchained. I feel like it is the duty of all cycling fans to get through all 8 episodes of
It's also good.
Unchained.
Like it's It's also not a burden. Yeah,
there
good.
Is.
It's fun.
There is some great stuff in it.
You will yeah. also learn things about last year's Tour de France. They may not be true, but you will learn them.
What is true? What is true? Who knows what is true?
What's truth?
It's whatever
What's
you truth? Want it to be.
Entertainment is truth.
Yeah, like Ronan, maybe Jesper Philipsen forgot to put like the little guard on. Because you know, do you remember when everyone was giving each other haircuts in lockdown? Me and my friends were doing it when we were living together. And I think we did that once where it's just like, because obviously none of us had ever cut anyone's hair before. And then suddenly you start and it's just like, oh, that is your, that's your scalp. So now you are bald.
That seems likely. That seems likely. All right, let's move on from the Dauphiné. Tour de Suisse, we're in the middle of it right now. Remco Evenepoel being there is kind of the, one of the big stories. What else do we get out of the Tour de Suisse so far?
Two riders have been pretty surprising to me. The opening TT set the tone that, okay, Remco Evenepoel, who is here as the heavy favorite, is going to do what he's supposed to do. And then since then, I mean, in the stages since then, the two climbing stages that we've seen, he's just been good, not great. He went way too hard on stage three with a little attack that got pulled back in. It was just vintage Remco, which I don't know, we can talk about that in a bit maybe, but I'd,
by vintage, you mean dumb?
It's still a young vintage, but we've seen it about every race for the last 2 years, that he loves to go all out, and it doesn't always work. We've seen him do it against Roglic a fair bit. Anyway, the real point I wanted to make, though, is that Felix Gall and Matthias Skelmose have been extremely impressive so far at this race. Skelmose is a rider that we have seen do big things already this year, and last year he won the Tour of Luxembourg. He was second at Flèche, but he had a great TT. That I was not expecting. He won stage three, and he was, again, very good on stage four. So, for me, Skelmose is the really, I don't know, kind of the revelation so far that he is able to be a GC-type guy like this. And then Felix Gall, yeah, he didn't come out of nowhere. He's been in the top 10 a few times so far this year. Austrian rider for AG2R. Won stage four with a strong attack. He has been awesome. So, really, you know, hats off to AG2R for finding a new young rider who is apparently pretty darn good at the GC. I mean, there's still half a race to go, but so far he just took the lead on stage four, and he has really taken this race to, yeah, Remco and Skelmose. And as of stage four, he is now in the race lead. I kind of expected Evenepoel to run away with this race, and that has not happened yet.
The commentator said on coverage just that Felix Gall was scheduled to ride the Giro, but then he had such a good Tour de Alpes that AG2R actually pulled him from the Giro to ride the Tour then? That was the first I'd heard about that, but wasn't he second on a stage of Alpes? And now he's won a stage of Tour de Suisse, so...
Yeah, he was second on the opening stage of the Alpes, and he was also then second a few weeks later, well, I guess a month later, in that one day, the Mercantour Classic Alpe Maritime, which Carapaz won. And he's only 12 seconds behind Richard Carapaz, who is a Grand Tour winner. So, yeah, pretty awesome. He's 25 years old. He's had a really good, I guess, 1 year up to this point, if you include last year as well.
Even with Remco Evenepoel and that big attack, even though it's in the Tour de Suisse, which I guess in the grand scheme of things doesn't matter that much, and he's also coming off the back of his COVID-19 positive, the sort of judgment and the discourse which he provokes at any given opportunity is just, it's still crazy. Like, I don't know how it keeps on going even after he's like won everything already. And personally, because I have a bet on it at 50-1 for Remco Evenepoel to win the Tour, which I'll make money on if he just lines up, but I feel like it's gonna mean that definitely doesn't happen, even though I feel I'm just refusing to be gaslit by Sudal Quickstep into the he's not riding the Tour thing, and then the last minute be like, oh, surprise, he actually is. But I think with reactions like, oh, well, you know, there we go, he's not a climber, he's not a proper Grand Tour contender, you know.
Well, didn't he have an interesting quote on that effect? Like something about he didn't want to get into the Tour and then get dropped and have Belgium explode or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which tells you a lot about where he's at.
Also, he won the Vuelta. Like I agree with you, Johnny. How is there still discourse? I think it's kind of a bummer.
And world champion.
That's what I was going to ask. Like, having won the Vuelta, what's it going to take to get past? Like, what, Johnny? What do you think he has to win to move past this?
I don't even know. And you'd think, like, if you think about it logically, him going into a tour undercooked so that he probably like has a bit of a disappointing ride and say abandons after the first week and then goes into the next year's tour and like there's not so much hype would surely you'd think make more sense. But the thing is with him, it probably wouldn't make any difference and it would just like increase the pressure because now he has to perform because he had a disappointing quote unquote tour this year if he lined up. You know, it's just it's too much.
I mean, the easy answer is obviously win the tour, but if we take that yeah. out of the equation, you know, that would answer all the critics. But I'm just wondering what he has to do before, if he ever wins the tour, that would actually just satisfy the Belgian. Is it the Belgian press or the Belgian public? I don't know.
Yeah, combination of both. Do you think a tour win would actually satisfy them though? At this point, is it just like
six tour wins?
He's just like
the
vessel for all. Yeah, exactly.
I think you'd have to like go win Roubaix or something. I don't know if the Belgian public know what to do with a GC contender.
At what point would Eddie become the first Remco Evenepoel rather than Remco being the next Eddie? That's probably the answer.
I think it's already too late for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You need five tours and
yeah. I mean, until they get that next person, which is never going to happen. That it's just always going to exist, that question, isn't it? No matter if you're Remco or whoever comes 10, 20, 30 years from now.
I do feel like Evenepoel, as a rider, is a little bit of a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation where people are highly critical of cyclists who are not entertaining. They don't attack. And he does. He tries to put in these attacks, these doomed attacks. And then they're also highly critical when they fail. It's like the only way you can really win is if you crush everybody by it, if you're Tadej Pogacar, right? And I feel like I am grateful for Remco Evenepoel for trying to attack, even if he gets caught and it's like, oh, Remco, the rookie mistake, he wasted so much energy early. I mean, fine, but at least he tried and it's entertaining, because if you don't try, then we still criticize you.
I 100% agree, Dane, but I think the interesting thing for me is that it either fails spectacularly or is incredibly successful in that he wins by minutes. And I just struggle to comprehend how he cannot like differentiate between which legs he has on any given day. It's like, surely you can feel the difference between being able to just ride away by minutes and not being able to ride away. But maybe he just never feels all that super, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
I mean, he even got criticized for contracting COVID-19. So I think he's the only guy who's ever been criticized for that, like across the whole world. So and that wasn't even the Belgian
Johnny, we've all done that. You've heard someone got COVID and you go, for fuck's sake. Come on, we've all had that reaction.
I want to pivot over to the most important team at the Tour de France, Marc Madiot's Groupama FDJ. We had a number of news stories out of that team this week. I mentioned that in jest, but actually there's two interesting things out of that team this week. One, they're leaving Arnaud Démare at home. He is very sad about it. Sprinter hasn't really been sort of at the very, very top of his game for a year or two, but he still wins a fair number of sprints. And interestingly, it's not a sprint heavy tour this year, but there are somewhere between 6 and 8 opportunities for the sprinters this race. And frankly, that's a lot more opportunities than David Gaudu is about to have. So an interesting decision on that front. And then the other side, another kind of angle on Groupama and French champions, etc. I just want to mention the Mont Ventoux race that happened on Tuesday. It was won by a 19-year-old named Lenny Martinez, and Lenny Martinez won over top of Michael Woods, Simon Carr, Domenico Pozzovivo was 7th, 15 seconds back. Ivan Sosa, who was sort of touted as like the next Egan Bernal, he finished behind. So this is a really solid ride, and this is a 19-year-old. I think it's worth highlighting. It's also interesting to me because he comes from good bike racing stock, basically. Most of the men in his family have been quite elite level bike racers. His father won the gold medal in mountain biking, cross country mountain biking in 2000 in Sydney. But his grandfather, his uncle, he's got this sort of like family history of being a very good bike racer. And as much as the top pros would like to tell us that it's all about how hard they work, genetics play a bit of a role in professional bike racing. And this kid clearly seems to have it. So I watch him with interest, Lenny Martinez. And yeah, Vontu, you know, it's a one day. There's a big difference between that day and you know, winning stages of the tour or being a true contender in some of these bigger World Tour races. But it was still a really impressive ride for a 19-year-old.
Two things straight off the top. Domenico Pozzovivo is just always seventh, I swear. He's just always seventh. And secondly, Lenny is an all-time name. So I'm happy that he's gonna be a guy. And I guess, you know, he's been showing like some promise and been touted for a while. And I guess that feeds into Marc Madiot's master plan of abandoning Demar and the sprint train and just going all in on climbing and trying to get a podium at the Tour. Because even if Godu isn't the guy, even though he came fourth last year, then seems like he's got another one coming straight up the pipeline. So,
most importantly, did you see how happy Martinez was in celebrating the win? Yeah, I mean, that's how it's done. That's how it should be done.
Oh yeah.
Did he stop his bike computer at the line?
No.
Good for him.
Marc Madiot writes into contracts that you're not allowed to do that.
Since we're on the topic of Madiot, can we just really quick talk about Unchained and how he's like, I think he's the star, one of the most amazing and enjoyable parts of the show, because like we in the cycling media know that he will dramatize everything, like that's just how he talks and that's what he does, and I just love that he's now, that's being shown to the world, the way that he is, that if, you know, if you're not in the peloton, you face death.
I mean, like, I knew how passionate Marc Madiot was, but I don't think I ever realized how passionate he is until I watched the show. I mean, like, that team talk, I'll not spoil it for anybody who hasn't watched it, but that team talk was something else. That was, maybe that was scripted for Netflix. Maybe Netflix came in and read the whole thing, because I refuse to believe that a cycling director could deliver such a speech.
He's like the one guy that was born to be on Netflix, even though he like predates Netflix by 50 years. My favorite, I mean, maybe we'll cover this in more depth in the Unchained pod, but when they had the very French school trip scene on the bus, and he's just there like jigging along to the song, and it's like, what is going on here? Like, it was such a pure distillation of France, and you could see how much joy that brought Marc Madiot to just be feeling so French.
I agree that he's one of the best pieces of that show, but he's also just one of the best characters in the entire Tour de France. Like he has been for a long time. I think English speaking audiences haven't gotten a lot of it, and part of the reason why, like Ronan, you make the comments, so you didn't know he was quite that passionate. Well, normally he doesn't walk around with subtitles underneath him, right? So, but he is genuinely like that, like all the time. He's like that all the time.
Yeah, he should.
And you can't. I mean, that would be great.
We're not going to be far off.
I think we're not that far off with AI. Like, we're going to be wearing...
Wear the glasses.
We're going to be wearing our Apple Vision Pros, and people are going to say things to us in French, and it's just going to write what it is underneath. Pretty soon. Pretty soon.
I just want to be there for when, after we get out of Bilbao and back to France, I'm there for his first, like, big gulp of French air. And then someone asks him, like, is it good to be back in France? And he's like, it's great. I just want to be right there to experience it for myself.
I might provide us with a segue out of this topic here and say that we need a Madiot cam or a Madiot tracker that we can just at any time during the tour click on and get a view of what Marc Madiot is at. And that is a segue, because I think we're going to talk about race radios next.
Yes, let's talk about race radios. So, well, Johnny, you tell me what's going on here.
Right. Story. Yeah, so ASO have done a deal with the teams to be able to publish or broadcast the radio communications between the riders and the teams during the broadcast, with a couple of caveats. It will be slightly delayed, and that's mostly because there's going to be like an intermediary, so someone affiliated with the team, I think, but also there'll be like a broadcast guy just like making sure that it's of use and informative. And then, like if you ever watched Formula One and the little graphic comes up and there's like a crackle on the airwaves, and then it will be a message from Jonas Vingegaard to his team car being like, I need a new bike or something like that.
Pet for softs.
Yeah. It's the sort of broadcast technology's already been there. The Tour de France Femme avec Zwift used it last year, and then the Flanders Classics have used it in Gent-Wevelgem and Tour of Flanders. It's an interesting sort of next step, I guess, in bringing everyone even closer to the race. You know, it's everything is incremental, and you don't get to the finished product overnight. Like with Formula One, this is now a huge part of their broadcast and the sport, because not only do you get to hear all of the dynamics between the teammates and the pit wall, but it changes the tactics, which I think I'm probably most interested to get your guys' takes on, because now there's like a whole nother level of tactics layered on, where you're like talking in code so that you can actually talk to your team, but then also you're maybe given false information that they know is false to then try and get other teams to do stuff, which that would be the main thing that I think would be interesting, is if suddenly the UAE like to Pogacar like attack, or like they're doing it every 5 minutes, and then Jonas Vingegaard is just there in the corner just like, I can't take this anymore. Like, what's going on?
You're going to need to come up with, it's going to be like baseball, like a sign to steal a base where, you know, you rub your chest and then you tap your head, because everybody has access to the stream. So you need to make sure only your people know what's being said.
I can't wait for the multi-21 moment between like Wout van Aert and Jonas Vingegaard, and for any Formula One fans that, or any non-Formula One fans, that was when I think it was like Weber and Vettel had like a message across the radio where they were supposed to swap positions on track, and one wouldn't give the position to the other, and it's like Wout won't help Vingegaard or won't drop back, or there'd be some code played out, and all we know is that the code wasn't adhered to, but we don't actually know what they didn't do that they were supposed to do, and then we're trying to read between the lines, and that's going to be fun.
I mean, I haven't raced with radios that much, but every time I have, mostly it's just like, and you can't really tell what's being said. So I think there's going to be a fair amount of that this poor soul is going to have to kind of parse through, whoever's responsible for pulling the audio out. And then the other thing is, like, I've sat in team cars before and listen to what directors are saying, and it's like 90% just like encouragement, you know. It's just like go 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 kind of stuff, and so I don't think that that's going to add a whole lot. But there are key moments, and I think if they find the right person to sit there and listen to all this radio chatter and can like help either move along the narrative or whatever, I do think that it could be a good part of the broadcast. It was a good part of the broadcast in Tour de France Femme last year. We didn't get a ton of it, but when it popped up, it was handy. I liked it.
I think that's going to be one of the most interesting things, actually, is just seeing the difference from team to team and how they use the radio. And like, you might have Marc Madio saying, alley, 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 and just words of encouragement. And then you might actually have, I don't know, Ineos or Jumbo. Well, maybe not Jumbo, judging by the On-Chain documentary, because they just seem to like lose their minds every time someone opens a gel wrapper the wrong way. But perhaps Ineos will be like, you know, very... Steve Cummings in the same documentary was, you know, was an insight into how his mind works and how knowledgeable he is. And like, I don't know Steve Cummings, but I raced against him and I got a very different impression racing against him than I did watching that show. And he came across in the show as a very, very, you know, helpful director to the writers, and that he would deliver useful information rather than just, you know, information that wasn't really useful. So just seeing the difference. And then you'll obviously have Movie Star, who will just broadcast all their dirty washing for, you know, the whole Tour de France to hear. So that's probably, I think that could be actually quite interesting, seeing the differences.
Yeah, Andreas Klier is another one that comes to mind as somebody who's just going to give useful information. Because when whenever you see him in the car, he's just telling everybody, okay, there's a pothole here, there's a wind on this side of the, like, he knows every inch of every road. So that's useful information.
And the other, on that note, the other thing that, you know, if I'm a huge F1 fan, for anybody who doesn't know, but, you know, thinking about the way this works in Formula One, you can, and trying to like think which driver could be which rider, I think Tadej Pogacar is going to be the Fernando Alonso, and that Alonso this year has been, you know, he's had a bit of a resurgence. He's got a good car. Finally, he's in the competitive end of the field. And, you know, he's obviously driving around these racetracks, 200 mile an hour around corners, and you can hear him giving his teammate advice over the radio on different setups that he could try in the car. There was one Grand Prix where he had spotted his teammate making an overtaking maneuver on another driver on one of the large screens. This is while Alonso was driving himself, and commented on the radio to tell Lance, his teammate, that that was a great overtake or something. So he, you know, he had just spotted it out of the corner of his eye, and this is the, you know, the capacity this guy has over and above what it takes to drive an F1 car. He can also think this clearly, and I think Pogacar is going to be the very same bike racing. The other example I think of with Alonso is in the Australian Grand Prix. He was shunted out of it there was a crazy restart scenario. Anyway, that doesn't really matter. But while he was basically still spinning in a Formula One car, he was already on the radio saying, think back to Silverstone last year. They restarted the grid in the same formation as before the crash and the safety car, and just that clarity of thought. And again, that's, you know, you could see riders then like campaigning for commissaires to enforce penalties on other riders or whatever using the radio because they know it's going to get broadcast on TV.
Ah, that's an interesting thought. That's a really interesting thought. So, two other things on this before we kind of, I think, wrap up for the day. One, only one team opted out, and that is, weirdly, Groupama.
Who'd have guessed?
Agreed to be part of the Netflix doc, and I think come out of the Netflix documentary quite well in general. We all already loved Marc Madiot, but now love him even more. David Goudou is definitely sort of a character that you start to want to support. And then they turned down the race radio thing, and there was a quote I think from Madiot, right, Johnny? Did he say something about this? He said why would we broadcast this? Basically,
it was like why, you know, you don't see what a football manager tells his team at halftime, but it's kind of like, well, you know, Goddard's just been dropped by Pogacar and Vingegaard, so tactics don't really come into it there. Maybe I don't know. I think it's Mario just like itching his contrarian side.
Yeah,
that's a little bit worrying for me though on the greater scheme of things also, because if teams had an opt-out, I really think this should have been either you do this in its entirety or you're not in this year's tour, because if teams had an opt-out, okay, FDJ were the only team to opt out, but it also suggests that teams will have quite a lot of control in what exactly is broadcast and what is not, and you know, nobody just wants to hear words of encouragement. We want something that's going to be useful. This is going to be of no use if it's not actually entertaining. Insightful, sorry, is a better word than entertaining.
I do wonder if Matteo and then anybody else who turned them down, I mean, in the case of the Netflix doc, for instance, I would assume that maybe UAE might come around once they see just how much they missed out on in the Netflix doc. Maybe the other teams that, you know, said no might come around because they'll see the impact that it has on their profile. Sponsors are going to, you know, benefit from this. So maybe next year Matteo comes around. I mean, I don't know if Matteo realizes... I think, you know, viewing the Netflix doc through the lens of the people that I know who are not really into cycling as much. Like I'm watching it with my fiance, and like she's just loving Groupama. And maybe once, you know, that sort of filters back to the team how that access is helping grow their profile, maybe they'll change their mind.
I have a final point on the radios thing, which is that UAE, which said no to the Netflix doc, said yes to the radios. And so we are actually gonna get some radio stuff from inside UAE and from Pogacar, which is something we are not currently getting from Unchained and that we've never gotten previously. So I'm pleased that they said yes. I'm just kind of surprised by the teams that said yes and no, basically. That Groupama saying no doesn't make a ton of sense to me in the scheme of what we've seen from them.
I think it's baby steps though. Like I was reading up on it this morning, and with Formula One, like they've had the broadcast and the radios for ages. And at the start, there was like complaints from some drivers that the way that certain bits of the radio being cherry picked was like not showing the truthfulness of what actually happened. But then now on the broadcast, you can like select exactly which team and which rider to listen to and watch. So it's just moved up. Like now it's like you can actually watch that person's race. It's not, you know, curated for you. And the other thing I think that'll make it work really well for cycling is that often you have big like lulls in action, whereas Formula One, you know, it's a much shorter event, and there's like, you know, there's so many camera angles around a track that it's much easier to sort of find action. So having those radio, that access to the radios in there, and you can just dip into conversations will add to it and stop people calling races boring, which if anything, that'd be great.
Yep. All right. I think that's a good place to wrap up here. yeah, go check out our Unchained Binge podcast. You can get those episodes on this sort of on the main Escape Collective channel. If you want to get them sooner, you can also go listen on the Unchained Binge channel. Just search for Unchained Binge podcast on wherever you get your podcasts, and you'll be able to dig it out. I think we're up to 5 on that one already, and only 3 on the main channel. So they're showing up a lot quicker over there. We're basically putting them out as soon as we make them. So go check those out. Make sure you catch this week's Wheel Talk and Pretty Serious Bike Racing. There's a fair amount of discussion around the cancellation at the Tour de Pyrenees, the cars on course, and all sorts of chaos and terrible things. We're leaving those discussions to those two podcasts this week. So if you want to dive into that, make sure you head over there. And of course, there'll be another Geek Warning this week with the crew. I think that's getting recorded today, actually. As a reminder, this is all member funded. Head over to escapecollective.com/join and make sure that you drop that paywall. Get rid of that paywall before we get to the Tour de France. You don't want to get hit with a paywall. Imagine it's 2 days into the Tour de France. Something crazy has happened. Johnny Long is on the ground. He's running around with a microphone. He's filing stories. You can't read them because you haven't signed up. You don't want this to happen to you. Head over to escapecollective.com. I'm not a very good salesman. /join and sign up. Sign up before the tour. We appreciate it. It's what keeps us in business. It's what keeps us making this podcast. So we're going to keep saying it until you've all signed up, basically. With that, we're going to call it here for a week, and we'll be back next week with another episode of the Placeholders Podcast. Thank you, Dane. Thank you, Johnny. Thank you, Ronan. See y'all.